But we have something like the MG, the Cyberster, yep, Cyberstar, yep, right? That's coming along. It sort of seems like it's fitting into that segment, but from an EV point of view. Yep. Is there something that Mazda's going to come back with that, or?
Yeah, no, I couldn't possibly tell you,
yeah,
but you can expect Mazda to always want to occupy that space.
Right.
And, you know, we saw MG off before.
Right. Okay, well, I think there's quite a bit to be read into that. So, Jeremy, how have you been since we last met?
Really good. Yeah. It's been interesting times, I think, in the UK car industry. So we've been navigating some complexities, particularly in, yeah, legislation. But I think when you've spent 35 years in the industry, you know, nothing comes as a surprise and you can roll with the punches, really.
Yeah, 35 years is a very interesting number. This year is actually my 35th year as well as a emerging journalist. So
we're halfway through.
We're nearly there. So tell me, before we get into the nitty-gritty stuff, tell me about your relationship with Mazda.
So I, it was quite a relatively seamless transition. I had 12 years at Ford Motor Company when I first joined automotive in 1989. And I concluded my last role there as the head of daily rental sales. And then we were in the process then of setting up, or the company was setting up, a national sales company for Mazda. And at that time, Ford owned around a third of the shares of Mazda, globally, had management control of the business. And up until then, it had been a distributor in the UK. And the company decided to move to more of a national sales company structure across Europe. And five of us moved across from Ford headquarters to this embryonic new Mazda business. And for me, it was just a two-year rotation.
Right.
And I moved in as fleet director, loved it at Mazda, loved a very different atmosphere from working from the UK's long-standing biggest brand to, yeah, one of the smallest. And it was just a great and exciting time, like working for a startup. And then, yeah, I progressed on to being marketing director, and then sales director, and then 2008 financial crisis, managing director, and I've been doing that role ever since. And I'm now, wow, probably the longest standing managing director.
It's a tough time to take on the gig, though, I suppose.
Yeah, but kind of makes sort of, you know, the things we've been going through in recent years, pandemic and everything else.
I suppose, you know, prepared you for that, I guess, in a sense.
I think you can see the highs and the lows of the industry. And
so what is it about Mazda's character, that its persona, that you think really stands out for you, that sets it apart from other manufacturers?
I think, well, perhaps mostly it's the people, and that sounds like a, yeah, cliche, yeah, but the fact that I've been there for over 20 years, you know, says something. But also all my team have worked for Mazda for 20 years on average, so all my direct reports. And I think there is this longevity, this sense of team spirit, and almost a family feel to the company that is very rare, yeah, in a car manufacturer. Most people, and particularly in my role, they move every 2 years. When I've been here as long as I have in this role, the dealer network in particular and the staff feel that, you know, a commitment made is a commitment delivered,
yeah,
because you can't run away from it. You can't wait for your successor to have to sweep up the consequences of it.
I suppose, and also because it's a smaller environment, you're more hands-on than I suppose you would be in
very
a similar
so.
Role at, say, Ford or something like that.
Completely. The speed of decision-making is, yeah, incredible. So we discuss something on a Monday morning and it's, yeah, implemented on Monday afternoon.
Yeah.
And there aren't 30 signatures required from around the globe to get, yeah, it done.
So you have the agility to react to, yeah, whatever's happening.
Yeah, agile, I think very focused, great relationship with our dealer network, yeah, and I think, you know, that's super critical in an odd business where you have this real two sides of the coin, yeah, the franchisee and the manufacturer.
Yeah,
sometimes,
yeah,
we try and encroach in each other's territory.
Yeah, yeah.
In our particular blend, yeah, we believe strongly in the power of a dealer network, not an agency model.
Yeah.
And that stood us in good stead, I think. As we've seen in recent weeks and months, a lot of manufacturers moving away from,
yeah,
commitment to an agency model. Crown
Car Guy. I think it's interesting times, as you said, because there is a little bit of a sort of a shift that's happening both in the trade and the industry, and certainly in terms of, you know, what policymakers want the industry to do. So in terms of, well, let's move straight into it. So for example, EVs. I mean, what is Mazda's current bestseller here in the UK?
So our best-selling car is the CX-5, which, mm-hmm, comes now as a petrol car, historically petrol and diesel.
Yeah.
And our only electric vehicle at the moment is the MX-30.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, the legislation, the vehicle emission trading scheme, as, yeah, it's now called, was the ZEV mandate, zero emission vehicle.
Oh, is that what they've called it now?
But,
okay, sorry.
But it really is, the emphasis being on it being a trading,
yeah,
scheme.
Yeah.
By 2030, the legislation requires all UK manufacturers to be registering 80% of all cars must be EV.
Yeah.
The legislation only goes to 2030, but the expectation is by 2035 it's 100%.
That's right, because they moved obviously the deadline from 2030 to 2035. But I believe that the requirements were actually still the same. I mean, actually, it was still, even when the deadline was 2030, it was still 80% by 2030.
So you, originally you could continue to register internal combustion engine cars only to 2030.
Yeah.
The government extended that to 2035, which is in line with the rest of continental Europe.
The rest of Europe as well.
The Labour have said that if they get into government, then they have a commitment within months to move it back to 2030.
Yeah.
So we're still in a state of not completely understanding that one yet. But the EV minimum mix requirements are concrete. And they'll
so what about for this year?
So 22% is the requirement.
22%.
However,
so 22% and you have one EV, and even that's in a twin model range. So you've got the electric version, then you've got the hybrid version.
The rotary
version,
generator version.
Yeah, the new rotary engine, which is great. And actually, this is the thing with Mazda. You actually, as a company, you continue to focus on ICE.
Yep.
You brought the rotary engine back. Okay, it's as a range extender, but it's back. So, I mean, where does it sit with you, you know?
So the legislation is 80% in 2030. Yeah. We absolutely will be compliant with that. And this legislation is meant to be a glide path to an end game.
Yeah.
And we will have the EVs in place to deliver that in the UK and, of course, globally.
Yeah.
The UK is preeminent amongst all countries in this drive towards a legislated move to EV. You know, there is no other country in the world that has it now written into law in the same way as the UK does.
What about this year? What's happening for you guys this year then?
So this year, we obviously, we have the MX30, which we will continue to sell through this year. But within the legislation...
But does that account for 22%?
No. And what is not really understood outside of people who are really immersed in this stuff is that the legislation has a series of what's called flexibilities.
Yeah.
And the flexibilities include borrowing from future years, banking now to then use in later years, trading, and of course the vehicle emission trading scheme gives the game away in terms of what it's meant to be.
Yeah.
Which is manufacturers buying and selling credits depending on where they are. So there'll be manufacturers who are 100% electric who may choose to sell some of those credits to manufacturers who aren't.
Are you finding yourself in that position at the moment?
We would never comment, but these flexibilities do allow. And there's one other, and it's a critical one, which is if you can get your CO2 in 2024 down for all the non-EVs to a level that is significantly better than the benchmark year, which was 2021, that allows an offset.
Oh, right.
Maximum offset is 65%.
Yeah.
So you can take 65% off the 22%, which means you only need to do 7.7% EV this year if you meet all the qualifications of the CO2 offset. Sounds incredibly complicated.
It is, yeah.
But then you look at it the other way, it's got to be good, because if you're making great efforts to reduce CO2 this year, then that's got to be good for the environment at the same time as working on an electrification strategy that has to be implemented fully by 2030. And that's exactly the position a number of manufacturers are in.
The fact is that if we have a situation where, for example, this year 22% and it's increasing every year, you have a situation where manufacturers are now looking at a customer that's walking into a dealership and you're going, right, I have to sell X percent of these customers electric vehicles. But surely the way the trade should work, going back to the sort of the old adage of the customer is always right, shouldn't we be selling customers the car that they need rather than the car we need to sell them?
I don't disagree with you. I think in a simplistic way, if you go back years, you built what customers wanted. Of course, it's more complex than that because you're building sometimes 4 and 5 months in advance of that point. But it is true today. I imagine all manufacturers have worked out a careful algorithm of what they need to sell this year.
Yeah.
And rather than pushing a customer into the wrong car, I'd put it another way, I'd say the dealers need to go and find the customers who want to buy the cars that we can manufacture. But it is a much more finely tuned with significant financial penalties if we get it wrong. So for every car that falls outside this VETS guidelines, for every extra internal combustion engine car we registered this year that doesn't have a corresponding EV in the right mix, there's a £15,000 per car penalty payable to the government.
Yeah,
and that's not viable for any business. So
it's not,
we have to find a way of balancing this complex model of what we can build to the customers that we can find who want to buy them.
Yeah,
and that
I mean, there's
new
two
way
ways of looking at what you and Mazda are doing. I mean, at the moment you appear to be at a disadvantage with just the one EV in your range. Although are there more coming or?
Definitely more coming, and they will come faster and thicker towards the back end of the decade, and of course. it's not just done for the UK, it's will be done globally applied across multiple markets. But it's certainly important to the UK that we have right and drive electric cars in a timely way to deliver the legislation. The flexibilities I mentioned, they only apply for the first 3 years of the legislation. So we're in the first year of those 3 years. Thereafter, there are some very, very
so the flexibility is in the first 3 years, and then it just goes back to that standard percentage.
Yeah.
Right.
So there is breathing space. It's been built in deliberately after a period of discussion with the industry. So I think it's fair in that respect. But you mentioned the point of, you know, pushing the market. At the moment, fleet is strong for EV sales, and there's strong incentives. At retail, it's still relatively weak. It's about one in ten sales.
You know, a lot of people have said that we should bring back incentives for private individuals, such as the subsidization, whatever, to buy an EV. Because at the moment, okay, for corporates, for fleets, you have the BIK, so that gives you a little bit of advantages there. But for the regular punter, there doesn't seem to be much of an incentive at the moment. Certainly not financial.
The industry's been calling for that because something needs to stimulate the retail market. And although manufacturers are reducing prices, making the cars more affordable, it's not leading to the mass adoption of electric vehicles in retail.
Yeah.
I think that's already been achieved in fleet, for the reasons you mentioned. But the government's in a difficult position. So coming up to the budget, they will have looked at the fact that for the last 2 years, the EV percentage mix of sales, so 2022, 2023, the EV mix of total sales is stuck at 16%.
Yes.
Let's assume that 16% naturally happens in 2024. If the government brings in, let's say, a £5,000 incentive, and applies that across all that 16% of cars that would have been bought anyway in a 2 million market, that's £1.6 billion before you've achieved an incremental sale.
Right.
And I guess when you're wrestling with where do you put your money, it's a very difficult decision about whether you stimulate the EV market or you're supporting health or education and so on. So I wasn't personally overly surprised that in the end we didn't see anything in the budget, but something is needed one way or another to stimulate the retail market.
And this is the thing, and I think the other important thing is that, you know, we have a situation when we look at it globally, there does seem to be a little bit of, I don't know if kickback is the right way of putting it, but certainly a little bit of hesitation, a little bit of cold feet we're now seeing from major global players, such as in America, for example. A lot of Ford, for example, is pulling back on, you know, F-150 Lightnings, for example. Other manufacturers appear to be doing the same. There are some manufacturers now that are saying, that had said that they would only be introducing EVs going forward, but are now saying, well, actually, we might have one or two hybrids. Do you think that there's a change happening? Do you think that maybe some of these things are not going to be, it's not going to be possible for policymakers to push these legislation through, that there may have to be some flexibility going forward?
So I can't really speak for the others, but as you pointed out, you know, we're probably going to be more of a follower into this than a leader, and that sits quite comfortably
with
me.
Do you think Mazda had a bit of foresight?
Yes. I won't say it was luck, I'll say it's absolutely down to clear and focused thinking.
Yeah.
But in seriousness, I think, you know, while 9/10 of the retail market is still buying internal combustion engines and highly electrified combustion engines that are bringing down CO2. Yeah. So let me emphasize, this is not, it's not about polluting fossil fuel cars. This is ever less polluting. But I think we continue to invest in the combustion engine. We're giving customers the cars they want right now. And we'll be responding and ready for the electrification as and when it happens. And I'm pleased we've got the cadence. What feels to me, the cadence is right.
Yeah.
But over the coming years, we will build to a position of much stronger electrification, which is, I think, the inevitable direction of travel.
Is it, though? Because, I mean, there is. I mean, you know, when you deal, and you must, I mean, again, being a smaller corporate environment, you must be dealing directly with customers as well. When I deal with a lot of the people that are viewing my content or consuming my content, I feel that there is a lot of negativity at the moment out there, particularly with EVs. There's a lot of myths, there's a lot of misconceptions, there's a lot of, you know, untruths in some extent. But it's kind of hard to get past a lot of those, you know. It's very difficult to push that narrative aside.
I think there are some very easy assumptions, lazy assumptions, that it's all about range, for example, and we need 350, 400, 500 mile range in order to convert me. As you know, we make a car with a modest sized battery. It's right sized, as we say. We know, fact, that if you look at 10 years of customer data for Mazda drivers of all powertrains, they drive an average of 26 miles a day. You don't need to be driving around with a 700 kilogram battery if you're only doing 26 miles a day. So we have a car that meets those needs perfectly. I had one, drove one for 15,000 miles, only charged it on public infrastructure 3 times because I charged it at home and work, and it became the perfect and unbelievably affordable commute vehicle. You know, it became almost my primary vehicle, even though I had a diesel as well at the time. And I think as people get more used to and talk to more people who have already made that change, it'll become more commonplace. But I think we're still in a transitionary phase, and the government legislation recognises that. You know, it's not 100% EV tomorrow.
Hope you're enjoying this video. If you are, make sure you hit that like button, comment, share, tell the world. But do you think that this should have been allowed to have been a natural transition? Because then people become more accepting of something. But, you know, because at the end of the day, no, people aren't deliberately obstinate. They don't deliberately want, I won't never have an EV. People obviously want the next new thing. They want the next big thing, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a desire for people to just deliberately shun EVs. But I think the sense that it's being forced upon them has caused this sort of reaction.
If there was a sense of force, well, that kind of moved away with the move to the 2035 end of internal combustion engine. On top of that, at least in Europe, there is still discussion about whether internal combustion engines could continue, but with a bio or e-fuel, which is another interesting dimension.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you effectively have a carbon neutral combustion engine, because it's not the combustion engine that's at fault when we talk about the environment, it's the fuel that goes in it.
Yeah.
And if that fuel is straight up the ground fossil fuel, then of course it doesn't make sense long term, but maybe there are other ways of looking at it. That is not currently on the agenda for UK government.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that will change. But I think, you know, all of these transitions take time. Move from, you know, to digital from analog.
Yeah.
You know, at some point you have to switch off the signal. People aren't wild about it. You have your classic early adopters who will do it anyway. Your mass adopters need a nudge.
Yeah.
And then the laggards who really won't change the tech until.
But we
the
have
old one
reached
goes.
Kind of saturation point, haven't we, with the early adopters? I think, and now we're sort of moving into that sort of secondary phase of the secondary early adopters, if you
and,
like.
And they have slightly different needs, and they need to be reassured in different ways. So they absolutely need to know I'm buying it at the right price. The technology is going to endure. It's not going to be replaced by yet more technology. Charging infrastructure.
But that's a very real thing though, isn't it? Because the evolution that we've seen in terms of the pace of development with EVs is much faster than we've ever seen with anything else.
Yeah, it's lightning quick. And, you know, discussion about new types of battery probably aren't helpful in people making a commitment to change now.
Yeah. I get that a lot. I get a lot of people saying, oh, we'll wait for the next generation, or we'll wait for solid state or whatever, you know.
Maybe, but there's the benefit of something like a PCP, you know, or a lease or some other form of acquisition other than outright purchase.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think this also helps with concerns about depreciation?
Well, certainly you could say the pace of change of technology doesn't help.
Yeah.
Doesn't help RV management.
Yeah.
But again, you know, most customers buy on a PCP, vast majority, and it kind of takes that risk away from them. You know, we continue to focus on getting people into our car in a way that is affordable, that reassures them that the range is right for them. That requires a slightly different relationship in the dealership with the salesperson, who needs to take you on a slightly different journey than just replacing your petrol car with another petrol car of the same model and make.
Yeah, but I think there must be a fear amongst people that they don't want to be cajoled into something that they don't want, such as an EV, for example.
Certainly true. There are people who are inquisitive, and we have to help them explore EV driving in a very different way. It's not just a short test drive.
But not just explore, but I think also get excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is the other problem with EVs at the moment, is that there's very little excitement. I mean, you guys have probably one of the most accessible and exciting cars in the market at the moment, which of course is the MX-5.
Mm.
You know, and I think that MX-5 now, along with maybe the Toyota GT86, are standing alone as the two cars that are within that bracket, which are fun, great driver's cars, but actually accessible. And it's something that, you know, creates excitement, it creates engagement, it creates an aspirational need towards it. Do you think we need something like that in the EV sector? We need to get people excited by them?
I mean, EVs undeniably are fast.
Yeah.
But fast
it's
not enough. It's something, the driving dynamics, the feel of a car are more than just straight line speed.
Yeah.
They're also quiet, they're really efficient.
Yeah.
But that's not an emotional engagement.
Yeah.
That's something else. It's valuable.
Yeah.
And you're right, one of the things Mazda's determined to do is to build driving fun into future EVs. And that can be done, and it takes a lot of thought because it doesn't naturally lend itself to that in the way that a combustion engine does, with all those moving parts, and that visceral feel of driving something that is complicated and almost alive.
Yeah.
And we have to build that into EV, so it isn't so, you're not so removed from the experience that it's just become a kind of white box, a kind of a white good.
Is it possible?
I'm no engineer, but I'm absolutely certain if anyone can do it, Mazda will.
Well, actually, I mean, you say that, but of course, the thing is that, I mean, you know, for a good couple of decades or more, I think, the MX-5 has pretty much cornered that market in terms of, well, it is the world's best-selling roadster, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, it just actually is, isn't it? So, but now on the horizon, okay, the Tesla Roadster is in a completely different league, so let's discount that one. But we have something like the MG, the Cyberster, right? That's coming along. It sort of seems like it's fitting into that segment, but from an EV point of view.
Yep.
Is there something that Mazda's going to come back with that, or?
Yeah, no, I couldn't possibly tell you, but you can expect Mazda to always want to occupy that space.
Right.
And, you know, we saw MG off before.
Right. Okay, well, I think there's quite a bit to be read into that. But I think, but this is a fundamental thing, isn't it? It's to try and get people excited about EVs, to get them involved in them. I mean, we can talk about the practicalities that it is, that people don't need as much range as they think they do. It is possible to run them. But just to get that emotional excitement, I think that's where the struggle is at the moment.
Yeah, the risk is, and I think, you know, in your profession, it's probably quite difficult to do group tests and find ways of separating these in the way that perhaps you did with a group test of more conventional cars in the past. And I certainly know, you know, people are very interested in engaging in articles and information about electric vehicles because they're in that exploring phase pre-ownership. But they get then a bit lost in the ubiquity of the whole thing and its utility, and it's just not very engaging, exciting if you're not careful.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find points of separation. That is something a manufacturer is going to have to work hard on, you know, to have brand relevance in an area where it could just become just very generic.
Yeah.
And that would be a big risk, because then we lose something that is really special about automotive that you don't find in the world of white goods.
Yes, indeed.
And we must retain that as an industry.
And the brand identity, which is important to brands like Mazda, right?
Absolutely.
Especially in this era where we have this consolidation, where we have sort of a lot of cross-fertilization, we have a lot of companies working together. I mean, you yourselves, I mean, to be honest, like, I didn't even realize that there's actually two versions of the Mazda 2, and that one of them is a joint venture with Toyota.
Correct, yeah.
So are we going to see more of that going forward? Is that an inevitability of going down this path?
I think that it's entirely possible that manufacturers will continue to find ways of collaborating, and we have done that as well, you know, in the past. We've shared some of our technology with others. Sometimes it's a practical decision and enables us to continue making the cars we make.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone wants to excessively do it, because it blurs the lines of what you are, but there will always be an element of that in I think any manufacturer's plans.
Are you excited about the future?
Always.
Or are you... I mean, to be honest, when I look at the industry, I see more confusion in the industry now than I have in 35 years. You know, because there's like two steps forward, two steps... Oh, we're going down this way. Well, no, actually, we might be going down this way. Or actually, we're committed to EVs. Oh, no, we're not committed to EVs. You know, so...
To your point, that's what makes me excited in the business.
Right.
So if I think back to 2019 felt like it was going to be pretty much like 2018, which was pretty much like 2017.
Right.
2020, pandemic, world changes, complete pivot of the business. You know, all our staff now work from home 2 days a week. We've changed the way in which we operate with our network and with our customers and the cars we make. We had the supply chain crisis. We had, you know, microchip non-availability, if you remember that.
Yeah.
We were coming off the back of Brexit. Since then, we've seen a bounce in exchange rate, which is really positive for Mazda. So we've been through all these ups and downs, and I don't think the world will ever go back to the simplicity I remember of 2019. I think we're now, it's constant change, it's a permanent thing, and that's no bad thing, because it keeps even someone like me, who's been 35 years in the business, still firing on all cylinders.
Keeps you engaged.
As long as we've got cylinders.
As long as we have all cylinders. Rotors. Of some kind of rotors, yeah, exactly. So the future is positive then, you reckon?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It's going to be...
Let's finally, just before we close, I know you've got to go to other meetings, and thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.
But just getting into a little bit of what we're seeing now in terms of AI and how that's entering into the automotive field. And we're seeing a lot of that. We see already, like Volkswagen have already said, that they're going to be introducing AI into their cars. Is that something that Mazda's also going to be looking at this year?
Of course, yeah. We will, you know, continue, like everybody else, pursuing some really interesting paths on vehicle connectivity. So the way in which the vehicle will support you and be part of your whole experience beyond just driving.
Well, you know what?
Driving.
Tell me about something I was reading yesterday, the UN Regulation 155, and how that's impacting car manufacturers. Because we're seeing some car companies having to pull back their model ranges because of the cybersecurity threat. Is that something that's going to be an increasing concern?
I think there's always a tension between vehicle connectivity and cybersecurity. And a lot of the legislation that's going through at the moment is absolutely focused on making sure the cars are future-proofed and safe. There's no point building in this technology if it creates risk. It has to do many things, but one is actually improve risk, which of course it does in many ways, like accident prevention and so on. But I think AI has got much more potential in terms of what the car can be.
Yeah.
You know, the car can be far more than just a means of getting from A to B.
Do you think that this would be a way of renewing our, or maybe evolving our relationship with the car?
Maybe. I mean, it's all a bit kind of sci-fi, but I can imagine a world where the car has a distinctive personality.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that.
Yeah.
I mean, people already name their cars, but what if it had an AI-driven personality as well?
Yeah.
You know. Not sure I want that, but there'll be people who will.
I don't know if we could have Kit from Knight Rider. I don't mind.
There's nothing wrong with Kit.
Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time
pleasure.
Today.
Good to meet you.
Check this out, guys. It's my book. It's my first novel, and it's written for car fans like you. It's a fun political action thriller. It's full of cool cars and spectacular action. Get your copy now at Amazon.com.